copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Just to give context, we're talking about how to talk to young people about sex, and I'll tell you the two contexts that I ask this question. One is, I have three children, and as they were growing, you know, at the beginning, it's their baby, and then you're playing toys, and all of a sudden you go, my child is starting to grow up. And there's this realization that sometime I'm going to need to talk about the things that actually created them, right? You know, this area of sex, and I'm thinking, when should I talk to them about that? Do I talk to them early when they're young? Do I talk to them a little later? And then it wasn't just the when, but the question of how, which was maybe in a bigger question. So I think about this as a father with my kids, and also I've been in youth ministry for many years now, and it's a big issue with young people. So I've led a lot of youth groups, work with a lot of young people. When is the right time to talk to them about sex? How do you talk to them about sex? What do you say? How do you handle this big flood of other information that's coming on? So how many of you are interested in this question because you're thinking about your kids? Raise your hands just so I can get some reference. Okay, great. And how many because you're working with young people and you're thinking about that? So it's about half and half. And some of you are doing both. You're thinking about it in both ways. So here's a question maybe just to get us started thinking. What are some of the barriers as you think about, okay, you're a dad, Kyle, and you think, I'm going to talk to my kids about sex. What are some of the barriers that come up? Like you go, oh, what holds you back? What?
Shame,
yeah, like, ooh, this could be an awkward conversation. Like, this is sensitive stuff. I mean, I'm going to be talking about it, and my kids are going to be going, oh, that's, you do that with mom? You know, that's actually one of the tough parts. Any other barriers? All right, how do you just start that conversation? So how to start? What are some of the other barriers as you think about doing it?
How much to share so that it's not hurtful, but it's helpful?
How much to share is not hurtful and not helpful? Because you're thinking, well, maybe they weren't thinking about this before the conversation. Now they're going to be thinking about this. Oh, no. Like, am I leading them somewhere that they shouldn't go? Anything else? Barriers.
It's too early?
Yeah, you're wondering, is it too early? How much to give them when? You might think, one of the things I thought of is well, I'm not an expert. And you might think, well, they'll just pick it up. They'll just get it from other places, and I'll just tell them, you know, be good or something like that, or I don't know what to say. Now, even in youth ministry, there's also that question of how open do we talk about this? This is the church. You know, do we use those words, those words that we can't use? And how specifically do we talk about it? Do we say, hey, you know, watch out for this and this? How open are we? I mean, it's a really interesting area. And because of those barriers, often the result is that we don't have those conversations. What's amazing is statistics will say that in the church, in youth groups, and in the home, there actually are very, very few conversations about sex, not enough conversations about sex, and we'll get into some of that just a little later on. So we start with the question, why should we even do it? And there's three reasons you should be talking with young people about sex if you're a parent, and we'll talk some about ages even here in a little bit, or if you're working with young people. And the first reason is that everyone else is talking to them about sex. Like, everyone else is talking about sex, particularly today. They are getting it all the time through every channel. And they're not telling them the view that God has. The average student watches, this is now when I'm getting up into more teenage years, but 50 hours a week average, they're connected to some kind of media. So 50 hours a week connected in some kind of media. Now, some of that could be something like Facebook, but that's also a channel for lots of media. 75% of TV shows contain sexual content. 75%. So of that 50 hours, just think of the amount of hours where there's some information coming out. It comes 8 to 10 times an hour. So 75% of 8 to 10 times an hour. So if you think that 75% of those 50 hours, and then we're getting 8 to 10 times an hour, there it is right there. 40% of song lyrics have sexual content. 40%. In one study, 20% of teens reported sending or posting nude pictures of themselves. So here's the other thing is we say, oh, they're not connected. They're not watching a show or something. They're just on Facebook or Instagram or something else. And as you know, it's become very 20%, one in five. I think when I was in school, I couldn't imagine, you know, what sending a nude picture of yourself to someone else. So this is, you know, we get guys collecting them and then passing them on. And it happens a lot more than we think. 35% of all downloads are related to pornography. 35%. One of the things they say the media functions kind of as a super peer. So you've got your peers telling you what's right, but the media is a super peer, like the big friend who's telling me about sexual activity. And it's basically saying that sexual activity is normative behavior for young teenagers. In a study of 2,100 11 to 17-year-old girls, only the 11-year-olds reported that they did not feel pressure from the media to begin having sex. Only the 11-year-olds. So as early as 12, they said, I actually feel pressure from the media that I should start having sex. So that's what's coming on around them. There was a study of 400 profiles on a popular English language teen chat site, and it found 49% of the teen girls posted pictures where they were revealing a revealing dress or partially undressed. So the Facebook profiles basically teach the girls, if you get attention, do something that's sexual. Now maybe it's not fully unclothed, but there's the sexualization of women. That's how I get attention. That's how I get likes. That's how people respond to me. And there's a small scale study done of 100 Facebook profiles of Dutch adolescents ages 11 to 18, and found that 24% had comments about their sexual experiences or behavior on their social media profiles. 11 to 18 years old, 24% of them had something about it. 35% of all internet, and by the way, you don't have to remember these numbers, I'm kind of just telling you, just it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere. 25% of all search engine queries are related to pornography, or about 68 million search engine queries a day. So this is just flooding our world. And I think we're aware of it, but maybe not aware of the extent to which young people who are kind of hardwired into contemporary media, it's just flowing their direction all the time. So somebody's talking to them about sex all the time. Is that true, those of you who work with young people? In fact, you don't even have to work with young people to know that, because they're talking to you about it all the time, too. I was talking to Michael Reeves about this the other night, and I said, I think there must be, I read BBC, I love BBC News, and I said, I think there's somebody hired at BBC to do a story on transgender every week, because that's just, it's like, why is there another story? And there's stories like these. Oh, you know, it's like someone found Christ or something. You know, there's these testimonials of the wonderful life transformation that I went through and become from a girl to a guy or a guy to a girl. Or, wow. And you just, every time I read it, I go, I don't agree. But what happens if you don't have your convictions formed yet? And you're just, and I mentioned that to him and he said, yeah. He said, not just the other day, I said there was a bank ad. And this ad for a bank, for opening a bank account, and it was two guys embracing, and one of them, I don't know if this is from the UK, so one of them was looking up with this face full of joy, and it just said, he said yes. And then they were saying, it's like opening, the joy you feel in opening a bank account is like the joy that man felt when the other man said yes to marrying him. This is a bank ad. So this is what's coming at people all the time. It's coming down the pike, and it's not God's perspective. Here's another reason: no one else is talking to them. Everyone else is talking to them, but no one else is telling them God's perspective. It's a very different perspective being presented in the media. And the prevailing picture looks like this. There's kind of three aspects to the prevailing picture that will be presented over and over again that is not God's picture. The first one is everyone is doing it. Like everyone is doing it. Like it would be so stupid if you weren't doing this. And doing everything. Like there's no boundaries. Sex before marriage, sex with someone else outside of marriage, homosexual relationships, bisexual, that's just the whole thing. It's boundaryless. But actually, this is not true. Everyone is not doing it. Even statistically, everyone is not doing it. In fact, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and I think this may be it. So some of these studies come from different places. Some of them are North American, some of them European. As I was getting into this, I went, oh, I've got to go back. And I don't know where this one was from. But the Centers for Disease Control, they said 57% of girls and 58% of boys aged 15 to 19 have never had intercourse. Now, that does mean that 43% and 42% have, but it's over half who haven't. And so this idea that absolutely everyone is sexually active is actually not true. Over half of people aren't. But if you look at media, it looks like everyone is. It's not being actually presented. And so people who aren't can kind of feel like, well, everyone else is and I'm not. That's actually not true. They say the percentage of teenagers who've had intercourse has actually been dropping consistently in the last 20 years. Which is interesting. So sexual problems are not new. But the media is telling us everyone's doing it all the time. There are no boundaries. 20% of young people are still virgins when they graduate from college. And again, you would never know that. You would never know that from media. You would think everyone is. So they're saying everyone's doing it. Actually, everyone isn't. Everyone isn't. They're also saying there are no boundaries. And this I began to talk about a little bit earlier. There are no boundaries. Multiple partners, everything, age, whatever, even the gender, and you get people like Miley Cyrus who say, I'm pan-gender, gender fluidity, today I feel like a boy, tomorrow I feel like a girl, and then sometimes I'm a girl homosexual, it just goes, there's all these different combinations, there's like 22 different combinations, just all no boundaries. And here's the last one, there are no consequences, which is also not true. Have you ever noticed, now there's a few shows where they'll actually carry things to the consequences, but for the most part you don't see unwanted pregnancies, you don't see sexually transmitted diseases, you don't see broken hearts that comes from physical relationships. It looks like it's just all absolutely wonderful and there's no consequence. That's the message that's being told to people around. And all three of those things are not true. They're not true. They're even not true if you don't believe in God. If you just study statistics, if you just study society, it actually is not true. Isn't it interesting? We've got this whole Me Too campaign that's going on right now. And of women coming forward and talking about the deep pain and anguish. And sometimes that deep pain and anguish was just being talked to in a degrading sexual way and nothing actually happened. And yet they're 20 years later still hurting over it. And what you realize is actually there are a lot of consequences in this area. We're going to get to this even more in just a minute. A lot of brokenness, a lot of woundedness that stays a long time. And this message that there are no consequences to our behavior is actually objectively not true. Even if I wasn't a Christian, I would say that is not a true message. And that's the message that people are hearing. And here's the other thing we need to realize. So everyone's talking to young people about sex. No one is telling them the prevailing message is very different than the message that God's giving. And here's the third thing. Your voice has more weight than you realize. I think we think, oh, there's this flood. Everyone's talking about it. I can't say anything that will mean anything. But actually, your voice has more weight than you realize. In Proverbs, so I'll talk first about the parental voice, and then I want to talk about the youth leader voice. So the parental voice is interesting in Proverbs 5 through 7, which is a long, extended passage about sexual purity. And if you've got your Bibles, look at Proverbs 5. And you'll see how he begins this passage. What are the first two words in Proverbs chapter 5 as he opens his passage on sexuality. What does he say? You got it there? How does he start? Anybody have it? I really want you to see this, so that's why.
My son.
What are the first two words? My son. So he's going to have a conversation about sex that actually goes on into Scripture, and he starts it in the voice of a parent, of a father. Why does he start it in the voice of a father? Because actually the voice of a father has huge weight when we're talking about this. He doesn't say, citizens of Israel. He doesn't say, students. He doesn't say, I'm going to speak from a professor voice. I'm going to speak from an expert voice. He actually says, I'm going to take the voice of a father right now as I begin to talk about this. The reason is because a father voice has huge weight. And a mother voice has huge weight. Mom and dad, their voices have more weight than you possibly, than you understand. And it's interesting that, look at verse 6. My son, chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 20, my son, keep your father's commands. So he's, even though he's writing Proverbs, he says, when we talk about this key area, I'm going to go into the mode of a father speaking to his son, because that has huge weight. I think parents don't realize how much weight your voice has, even when the whole world is saying something different. It has huge weight. It's important, the people who write on this say it's important, even with the support of external resources, it's important to remember parents are the most important sexuality educators for their children. Parents are the most important sexuality educators for their children. Study after study shows that teenagers want more information about sex than they're getting. When asked how would they choose to learn about sex, they gave them different possibilities. You can go to course, you can read a book, your friends can tell you different things like that. 9 out of 10 say from their parents. This is a secular study that was done. This is not a Christian study. 9 out of 10 say from their parents, not from their friends or health class or books. So I think parents don't realize that actually your voice has more weight than you realize, and your children would actually rather talk to you to learn these things from you than from anyone else, which is why when Solomon goes into this in Proverbs, he goes into the voice of a parent, of a father speaking to his son. Now the study actually has a double-edged sword, though, because when asked if they actually talk to their parents about sex, however, only 1 in 10 says yes. So 9 out of 10 say from their parents, but only 1 in 10 say yes. So 9 in 10 say that's what I want to hear. 1 in 10 say it's actually happened. You see this discrepancy, that it's not coming through that parental voice. And the reason, according to most teenagers, is that their parents hold back. The parents hold back. They don't have that conversation. Now, here's the other thing. The same study said, it said at least 50% of the kids said it was really awkward. So just because young people respond like, oh, that's awkward, I don't want to hear from, don't say that, and that it's awkward for you, that it's awkward for both of you, it continues to be the place, they're saying, I want more information about this, and they're saying, the place I want more information about this is from my kids. The report also finds that 42% of parents say they've talked to their teens many times about how to say no to sex. 42%, I don't know if I've got that one out here. No, I don't, yeah. Only 27% of teens agree. So there's a huge difference between the perception of the parents about how much they've talked about this and the self-report of the teenagers. In fact, 34% of teens say they've never only once talked with their mom and dad about how to delay sex. So that's you parents. So I just want to tell you, your voice has more weight than you realize. Now to you who work with youth, your voice has more weight than you realize, because often you are parent figures or older brother figures. You really, you're more than just a youth leader. You really create a secondary family for young people. And you're kind of the older brother or uncle or your hero. And in those young years, I'm particularly thinking now, the years when you go through puberty and all this becomes very important, because now you have the equipment and the drive to do something. So that's when we talk about timing. You have to make sure you get the conversation by the time you get to that point. And they're in that and they're figuring that out. Actually, you You don't have quite as strong a voice as parents, but you probably have the second strongest voice in their life because you're coming from their secondary family, which is a youth group. And so it's really important that that you have these conversations. Really, really. So you got this flood of information coming from the world. Your voice actually carries a lot of weight. And most studies would say that voice is not being, you're not using it. You're not using it. You're not talking. So when you have those conversations, what do you say? And I think sometimes we go, well, there's all this information, I could have all this data. And the thing is that you may have that conversation at an unplanned time. You won't have notes when you have that conversation. You won't actually be able to remember these statistics or a lot of different things. You actually need a very simple outline in your head for when you have this conversation. I've worked with young people for many years, and I just have a simple outline in my head that I go through over and over and over again. It's only got 4 points in it, because I can't remember where. It'd even be better if it had 3, but it only has 4. And you can expand these points and talk about them a long time in a lot of different directions. But kind of like the 4 spiritual laws, okay, we're going to give you 4 points about this is really what you need to cover when you cover it. And you can actually cover it over and over again in various ways. But there are 4 big themes to God's view of sex that somehow we need to communicate. Here's the first one. Sex is good and a gift from God. And this is always where you start, because it's very easy to say, watch out for that, watch out for this, don't do that, oh, you can get hurt doing that. And then what it can feel like is the world has thought up something really amazing called sex, and God's trying to keep you from it. That's how it can look. And it's just really important to take it back, to take out the ground. Hey, let me just tell you something. Hugh Hefner didn't think of sex. You know, the Pornhub didn't come up with it. It's God created it. Man and woman, they were naked in the garden. He looked at it and he says, it was good. All pre-fall. I mean, he thought up how our bodies were going to fit together. He thought up the fact that it was going to be pleasurable, that you can enjoy doing it for years and years and years. That there was a deep connection that, I mean, it's just, think of how creative and amazing it is. When I talk to youth, I just thought, wasn't God amazing? He thought up this, that's really being quite creative to do that. And then it's not just about, his goal wasn't just, I need to get them to do this so they have more kids. He said, this reason a man's going to leave his wife and they're going to become one flesh. The two will become one flesh. And then Adam says, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my bone. I mean, this is about something joyous and wonderful. And it's so holy that Jesus uses it as a metaphor for his relationship with the church. That's how good and holy it is. He says, he goes back to creation just like, and he says, the bride, just like a man's going to leave his wife and be clean, leave his father and mother and be clean to his wife. That's Christ in the church. So this is a wonderful, good, clean, amazing thing. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But look at Proverbs 5, right in the middle of these warnings, 15 through 19. He's saying, drink, Proverbs 5, 15, drink water from your own cisterns, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets? He's not saying your springs shouldn't flow. And I'll think about this, he's talking to his son, and he's speaking metaphorically. So this, just think for just a little bit, and you know what the springs are, okay? So, should they overflow in the streets? Why just let them go out anywhere? Your streams of water in public squares, let them be yours alone. Don't lose this precious thing, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed. May you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. This is scripture. May you ever be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the woman's of the bosom of another man's wife? He's arguing, he's fighting fire with fire. He's saying, why would you trade something that's amazing for something that's much less? And I think that's part of the message that we need to say, is there's something just amazing here that you don't want to lose and you don't want to damage. And it's good and it's God's. Why would you risk that? Why would you lose that? That's just an amazing, good, precious, precious thing. There are kind of 3 views of sex. One of them is sex is gross. And that's often what people think the Christian view is. Ooh, you know, I mean, let's not talk about it. even people go to marriage and sometimes their first night, they really haven't, you know, let's just kind of, something happens under the sheets. I don't know. We haven't talked about it, but, because it's kind of, ooh, that's a little gross. That's one view. Sex is God, which is the view of the world. It's worshipped. And God says sex is good. So it's not gross and it's not God. It's good and it was created by God. It's not invented by the media. And I always begin any conversation about sex talking about the fact that a good God made it, and he made it to be good and wonderful and absolutely amazing. So any thoughts or comments on that before we proceed? Okay, let's go on to the second point. Sex is good and gift from God. Sex is powerful and can deeply touch or deeply wound. Those of you who are married, you know how powerful it can be. How absolutely powerfully amazing it can be to be joined in sexual union with your partner. It's just amazing. It's really powerful. But it can deeply touch, but it can also deeply wound. Anything powerful has powerful both to bless, power both to bless, but also to destroy. And when I started working with youth in Havajov, which is not very far from here, I had a young man in my youth group who had just come back from the military. And I said, what did you do there? And he said, at that time, military service was mandatory in Czech. And he said, I was responsible for Semtex. Now, I don't know if you know what Semtex is. It's a drink, but long before it was a drink. It's a very very powerful plastic explosive that was invented by Czechs, I think it was. Is that right? Semtex. And so I went, you were, wow. I said, what was that like? And I start picturing, I bet they just went out and, you know, put this plastic explosive on things and just blew things up. And when they, you know, there's a tree and there's the tree's gone. I mean, wouldn't that be, you know, there's somebody in my parking place and not anymore. You know, this is great. I mean, this you can use it to do so many things. Open a way through a mountain or, wow, that must have been so much fun. I said, so what was it like to work with Semtex? And he says, I never touched Semtex. I said, I thought that was your job. And he says, yeah, we talked about it. We prepared to do it. But I actually never used it in 2 years in the military. And I said, why? He says, because it's so dangerous, which is really interesting. And that is powerful things. The power can be used different ways. You know, you can be, oh, this wonderful symptom. Oh, I have no hands. You know, let me move that car. Oh, my head's gone. You know, so they know that power used in the wrong way can actually destroy. And sex is powerful. It's powerful. It was made to bring people together and glue them. And what happens when you bring people together and glue them and then you pull the two pieces of board apart? Well, the glue is stronger than the board. And it rips people in ways that they don't even anticipate. And there's part of me left with that other person and part of that person left with me. And something happened and I'm actually damaged in the process. If it's not used right, if Semtex is not used right, it can damage it. And so people don't realize that the power, if it's not channeled correctly, there's all kinds of protocol around Semtex because they want to use it right, you know, blow up the Russian tank maybe, but they don't want to use it wrong, blow up my fellow comrade, so they have to be careful. Now this is... a recent study by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention revealed that 1 in 4 teenagers had an STD. You know, so there's actually all kinds of different danger. One of them is sexually transmitted diseases that then can haunt you the rest of your life, can be passed on to your kids, can make you sterile so you don't have kids. You know, there's things like that. Little fooling around a little bit could mean that you're not a mom and you never can have kids. You know, that there's things like that that nobody ever talks about. 1 in 4 has an STD. 10% of young women who first had sex in their teenage years reported that the first time was involuntary. 10%. 1 in 10 girls, it was involuntary. So you get into that, and then all this Me Too stuff. Sometimes when I read some of the Me Too stories, I go, how did you end up in that situation? You know, you get too close to this thing. And what were you doing in their room late at night, just the two of you, you know, after your interview or whatever? They're not understanding this thing's actually dangerous. It can blow up and take my hands off. And they're treating it like it's not. And there are lots and lots of wounded people, broken people because of this. I've worked with young people for many years and many counseling sessions, many prayer times with them. And you wouldn't believe how many times comes up something that happened 10 years ago, 15 years ago, related to sexual sin, sexual abuse, something sexual that is a bleeding wound today. It's a bleeding wound. It's like it was yesterday. It took someone's hand off. And young people have to recognize this is just not neutral territory. Powerful things can be used powerfully for good, but they can also powerfully damage you in lasting ways. And you really need to know that. And I think we see that in the Me Too campaign. It's so crazy for me in media that on one hand you say everything's allowed, you know, let's do a gay parade, you know, or something like that. And on the other hand, you have people going, somebody talked to me wrong sexually and I'm still wounded today, 10 years later. And you get both of these being pressed forward in media, you know. Me too, I was hurt by sex. Allow everything. And you go, are you kind of putting these two things together? Are you seeing that actually this, you know, makes this and that this thing is actually dangerous if it's not used correctly? So we talk about this. Now, by the way, if you're talking with young people, the thing that if you're talking about something, a consequence, the thing that's most powerful to them is someone that they know or someone like them that has gone through it. They've talked about they've come into high schools to help kids not drive and drink. And they'll show statistics and different things like that. And then they said, did you change your behavior? And they didn't. And they said, that's because my friends drank and they drive and nothing happened. So, but whenever you can actually get testimonies close to them or stories that are close to them or even personal things that you share, then all of a sudden it becomes real because they're always reading everything through the lens of relationship and they want to know, hey, does that affect people around me? If it does, then maybe it's real. So sex is powerful and can deeply touch or deeply wound you. Any thoughts about this? Okay, that's chapter number two. Chapter number three. Or anything else? This is it. Sex is precious and can be easily damaged, stolen, or destroyed. You know, you see those signs when you park your car and it says your car is not a safe. if you got my daughter left her camera in her car in Osterville last week and someone broke through the window and she doesn't have a camera anymore. And we both sat there and went, why did you leave your camera in the car? You know, precious things can get robbed. Precious things can get destroyed really easily. And so that's why we have safes. That's what you watch things that are precious for you. And what would happen? I really enjoy photography. I taught my daughter photography too. And we've got this wonderful, neat, amazing Nikon camera. Anybody into Nikon? It's always the Nikon, Canon, you know, get a little war going, which is the best? And some of you going, Sony. So I'm a Nikon man, been for a long time. Well, I've got this really cool Nikon, lots of pixels in it, you know, nice lens. And it, if I left it on a bench in a train station, it'd be gone. You know, it'd just be gone. So I watch it closely. Now, what would happen if... let's say this weekend I decide to build a wooden fence around our yard. And I start in and I get the wood, you know, and I dig the holes in the ground. I put the first posts in. I go, I find the nails and I go, and I can't find my hammer. And I realize, oh, somebody borrowed it. And then they went on vacation. I can't get it back. And none of the stores are open right now. I can't buy one. I don't have a hammer. No rocks around here. And then all of a sudden I see that there's my camera right there. And I kind of grab it. You know, you normally hold it like this, but if you spin it and you hold it by the lens, I mean, it's kind of like a handle, right? I mean, it just kind of has that. And it's got some nice weight to it. And the bottom end of it, it's a flat surface. It connects really well with nails. And so I take it and I start going, I put the first nail and I start pounding it in. And you know what? It works. Isn't that amazing? It works. I mean, people say it's just a camera, but it's a camera and a hammer. They didn't know that. They didn't tell us that. So I start using it, and I start pounding in nails, and I do my whole fence, and I go, you know, they told me that camera wouldn't work for other things, but they're wrong. I mean, it makes a great hammer. The instruction manual didn't say that, but I have personal experience. It's a great hammer. And then I go the next day to take pictures, and I don't have a functional camera. So... It'll work as a hammer, but using it as a hammer destroys it as a camera, and then I don't have a camera. And so some people say, you know, wow, I can sleep with my boyfriend and five other guys and not worry about this and try out women and men relationships. And they go, you know, you said it wouldn't work, and it works. It works. And then they fall in love and step into marriage, and it doesn't work. It was damaged somehow. And the area where sex was meant to function for the rest of their lives, they just have years and years and years and years and years of baggage. By the way, statistics show that premarital sex has a huge impact on the length of time someone lasts in marriage. And the people who live together, the divorce rate is twice as high in people who live together than people who don't. Their marriages don't last. So you think that whole argument of we got to learn before we step into marriage because we don't know if we're going to be compatible, you're actually using sex outside of the lines that it should be in, and it will get damaged. And so precious things need to be protected. So Proverbs 5 also talks about this. Proverbs 5, verse 20 through 23. And it says, you know, why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of an unknown man's wife? For a man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his past. The evil deeds of a wicked man that snare him, the cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly. So he says there's going to be consequences. Look at 1 Corinthians 6:18. And it says, flee from sexual immorality. Now, I was actually reading yesterday a book by someone who said there's passages in the Old Testament that teach that premarital sex is wrong, but there's nowhere in the New Testament that does. And I'm going, oh, come on, give me a break. Those are some. Flee from sexual immorality. This word here is porneia. And it's a broad word that basically refers to sex outside the boundaries of marriage. So it includes premarital sex, includes adultery, includes homosexuality. It's a broad word. And it's the same kind of thing that back in Proverbs, when he says, he's talking the whole way through Proverbs, he says, stay away from the foreign woman, the woman that's not yours. So the strange woman. And so basically both of these definitions say, use broad words to refer to anything outside the bounds of marriage. The strange woman, the one who doesn't belong to you, which means she doesn't belong to you because you're not married to her yet. See, premarital. She doesn't belong to you because you're married to someone else and there's someone else there. She doesn't belong to you because actually you're a woman and you shouldn't be relating. There's other passages about homosexuality. And then you see later on in the New Testament where it says, keep the marriage bed pure. Well, you have to keep the marriage bed pure before you step into it, as well as while you're in it. Do you see what I make sense? How can you? The marriage bed is not pure if two or three people have slept in it before you go into marriage. So, anyways, you have to understand the context of some of these pictures that are actually broad pictures, and they include bestiality. They include sex with animals. It's like, and we're going to get to that in a minute. There's this place that God wants sex to happen in. And when it's outside of the place, that's when we run into trouble. So it can be, but look at this, 6:18, it says, he who sexually sins against his own body. So it's the only one actually in Scripture where it says, when you sin, you're actually sinning against yourself. And then he says, don't you know your body's the temple of the Holy Spirit? And also in Romans, when it talks about this, it's the same thing. He says they bear in themselves, in their own bodies, the consequence of their sin. So sexual sin actually damages us. It's not just some objective judicial thing that God has out there. But I'm hurting myself in this area. And that's one of the reasons why God's so concerned about it. So God's design is the boundaries of marriage. And he wants to protect your mind. He wants to protect your body. He wants to protect your future. He wants to protect your relationship with God. He wants to protect your mind. He wants to protect your body. He wants to protect your future. And he wants to protect your relationship with God. He says, hey, the Holy Spirit's in you in this temple, and this is going to actually damage your walk with God. And it will. So it just will. It has so many consequences where people for, you know, one or two exciting experiences will then mortgage, borrow off of years and years and years of health down the road. So something's precious. I don't leave my camera out. I don't use it as a hammer. I keep my wallet close because precious things can be damaged and destroyed. I want to keep them. They're so precious. I want to keep them. So it's not like, oh, there's a line, there's something really good over there and I can't get to it. No, I have something good and I don't want it to be damaged and destroyed. I have something precious and I don't want somebody to rob it from me. So that's the biblical stance. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, here's the last one. Sex needs protection. And the protection is the boundaries of marriage. Delight yourself in the wife of youth. May her breast satisfy you always. Why be pulled away to another man's wife? And this is what the world says. Marriage, this little bitty... Marriage is such a huge territory. Like such a huge territory. I have been married for... Okay, this is almost 30 years now. 30 years. How many times have I experienced sexual pleasure and oneness and the joy of sex with my wife? Many, many, many times. And it's actually something that we work on. We read books on. We talk about it. We try to get better on it. And you know what? It gets better. Actually, I would say that there... even this year we were saying, you know, our sexual relationship is better this year than it was last year. We've been working at it for 30 years. It actually is hard to learn to have really good sex with someone. You have to really learn them. You have to learn how they work. You have to learn how their body works, how their mind works, how to create a safe environment. It has to be safe for there to be true joy. And I get this safe environment to learn and grow and get close. And not only that, but it's not just an emotional experience. It reflects... when we're joined together in sex, it's reflecting all 30 years of richness that we have together. It just gets better and better and better. And so this field of marriage is huge. It's just massive. It's years and years and years. It's so much joy and richness. This joy that spills over into, that meant that we had some kids. Because the joy of our sexual union produced kids that we love. And actually, my wife... I don't know if this is really true, but she said, David, sometimes I think I actually see angels. And I said, really? So I don't know. I mean, I don't. So I don't know if this is true or not. She kind of describes how it is. I go, really? She says, yeah, I see them at spots where the Bible says that they're there. They're around us. And I said, when did you last see them? She said, oh, when we were having sex. I said, you're kidding me. And she says, no, I just... It was such a moment of joy and pleasure and enjoyment. And I opened my eyes and looked down the room. And I just felt the pleasure of God in that place. You know, why would you risk something like that? Something that's so wonderful and so joyous and so amazing. And so we got to think forward. We got to think about our future. About protecting, for young people, protecting my future wife. Protecting something that's really good and precious. Looking forward to it with joy. And not just, no. No, no, this is yes. This is years and years of yes. This is amazing. In fact, it seemed like a long time that I had to wait. But I've been enjoying sex for a long time. And I plan on for quite a bit longer. You know, this is just really an amazing thing. So there's this goodness. There's this goodness. And it's like, actually, I don't know what it's like in your country, but in the Czech Republic, when someone buys a piece of property, the first thing they build is a fence. It's the first thing they build. Because they want to say, this is mine, and they want to keep other people off of it, and they want to keep that closed in. Well, that fence is marriage. And what's inside that fence belongs to you. And why would I just kind of let anything happen and not worry about and not ever have my own... In fact, there's a guy I'm working with who is, this is an interesting situation because he's divorced and then started dating another woman. And because he's so concerned about it not working, they're living together and he's afraid to step into marriage. And I told him, okay, this is like, he built a house. I said, this is like going to the lot that's right next to you and just saying, I don't know if I'm going to buy the lot, but I want to try and build a house there for a while and see if it works. Well, you're building a house on someone else's lot. Would you ever spend money to build a house on a lot that doesn't belong to you? Because it means it could be just gone like that. And I said, you're starting with the first floor, and you aren't putting in a foundation, which I guarantee you the first floor is not going to work. You know, you have no foundation. And so you're investing all this time and all this resources because you want to see if it works. But I'm telling you, it's not going to work because of the way you're doing it. You know, your first floor will not. You said, and then I'll decide if I'm going to put the second floor on. Well, your first floor is not going to work because you don't have a foundation. And the whole investment's going to be gone because you don't own the land. And the way you're going about it, I said, you would never build a house this way. You would buy your land, secure it, put your fence around it, invest for the long haul, make sure it had a foundation, it was going to stand for a long time. So why do people do that in relationships? And then they go a couple years down the road and they're surprised when it all falls apart. And they're wounded and disappointed. And how many people are in marriages where they're so disappointed and because they just don't follow God's instructions? So sex needs protection, the boundaries of marriage. So do you hear that? And well, actually, let me add one other thing, and then we can start discussing this. Three things that will allow your voice to be heard, and then we can start putting this together. Relationship. My son. So this is not a judge who represents a law that's telling people the consequences of the law. This is a father, a mother, an older brother who cares deeply. That's the tone that it needs to come in. I was talking to a friend of mine who his son was in a teenage years, and he says, he's just not listening to me. We're arguing all the time. I said, where are you when you're arguing? He says, we're in the living room. I said, and in what position? And he said, he's standing and I'm standing and he's standing ready to walk out the door. You know, and I said, that's not the way friends talk. They don't talk standing in the living room. I said, where does he run to when he goes out of the room? He says he goes to his room. I said, do you go to his room? No, I don't. I said, where do friends hang out? They hang out in rooms. I said, go to his room, ask his permission to come in the room, because that's what friends do. Sit on the floor. He said, I'm older. He said, teenage friends sit on the floor. So it doesn't matter. You're dad, but sit on the floor and give enough time for a long conversation and it will be a totally different conversation. Because friends have time and they talk about it and they don't freak out and they hang. So it's got to come through this friendship voice, and it's got to come instead of, whoa, you think that? It's got to go, yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that. I understand. I wonder what God thinks about that. He needs to have that relaxed dialogue where it goes a relationship, authenticity, and that's supposed to be B. So it goes A, B, authenticity. Young people can smell a fake from so far away. And so if you feel a little awkward, just say, you know, it's a little awkward for me to talk about this. Just say that, you know. If they ask a question, you go, wow, I really don't know. I have to look in that. If they say, it's hard, you go, yeah, I mean, it was hard for me too. There needs to be that authenticity, but also your authentic hope for something better for them. They'll always put more weight on what they consider to be authentic. And then loving leadership, that actually is C. You got to love them enough to lead them. You actually don't love them if you don't talk about these things. So they would go, oh, this is awkward. You're putting pressure on. You know, but if somebody's driving towards a cliff, it's really unloving for me to keep my mouth shut. You know, if somebody's doing drugs that are going to damage them, it's really unloving for me to not talk about it. That's unloving. And so you got to realize that leading in this area is actually an expression of love, even though it may be framed as judgmental or things like that. When a doctor says, hey, if you put those things together, you'll die, or you know that cancer that's in you, if we don't take it out, you're going to die, that's not fun news, but it's actually very loving. Okay, here's my last question to you, just as we end. Are you talking with young people about sex? Because you'll be a great blessing to them if you do. So thank you so much for your attention today, and God bless you all.